Welcome to Story of a Storyteller. I'm your host, Connor Braden. This is the show where I found out all about the ins and outs of the lives of storytellers of all kinds. You can find my free novella, The Stolen Dagger, episode show notes, links to all sorts of amazing books, and more at connorbraden.com/podcast. Enjoy! And welcome to Story of a Storyteller, the podcast where I talk to and get to know and just be really nosy about the life story of different storytellers that I come across. This week's guest is Andrew Shanahan. Andrew Shanahan is the founder of Man v. Fat and the author of Before and After. His novel released at the exact right time, as it launched during the kind of first global lockdown due to COVID-19, and it is set at the end of the world. What makes Andrew's novel so unique, however, is that it tells the apocalypse survival story from the point of view of a morbidly obese man. First, I talked to Andrew about his career as a journalist. In particular, he tells me about his time working for a children's magazine. One article he wrote was about the worst injury ever. And if you watch the interview instead of listen to it, you'll find it on the website. You will see me squirm as he tells me what the worst injury ever actually is. I am not surprised that the article he wrote for that children's magazine had loads of complaints from parents. Andrew also worked as a restaurant critic, something that was the start of his weight gain. When he tried to lose weight, he was disappointed about the female-centric weight loss programs, and he started up Man v. Fat, a hugely successful weight loss program for men. The whole interview is a thrilling listen. Before we get there, though, I finally had a bit of a breakthrough with my writing, and I've really started getting back into it. And if I'm honest, I'm kind of surprised at how much it has helped my mental health. I think I said it last week, but essentially it just kind of really struck me that, you know, writing for some people might just be a hobby or a career choice or whatever, and it is that for me, but there is also an element of I have to do it to it's like the creation process really helps me balance out any negative thoughts I have about myself or the world or whatever. So it's I'm just so happy I have finally gotten back into the flow. Also, I have said before, I'm using a new technique for planning the book, and it's just so exciting because now that I'm getting to the stages where I can see the story starting to take shape, it's really affecting, like, it's just, I don't know how to explain it. I'm just really excited and passionate and giddy almost about where the story is going to take me, and more importantly, where it's going to take the future readers. Anyway, enough about me and my waffling on. But before we head over to listen to Andrew and myself talk about his book and his program, Man v. Fat, I'd love to ask if you could leave a review for the podcast. The podcast isn't a free hobby. I'm not complaining about the loss of money or anything like that, but it is something that takes a bit of out of my pocket. So in order to kind of gain money back, I'd need to get more listeners. So if you could leave a review on podchaser.com/story of a storyteller, that's podchaser.com/story of a storyteller, it would make a huge difference. The more reviews a podcast has, the more likely it'll be put in front of people when they're searching, the more likely people hear about it. So tell a friend about whatever episode, this episode or any episode that you particularly liked, and let them know about how good of a show that this is. Anyway, enough about me and begging for reviews and all that nonsense. Let's hear Andrew Shanahan. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Story of a Storyteller. And my guest today is Andrew Shanahan. How are you, Andrew?
Very good, thanks, Connor. How are you?
I'm good. Can I check, is it Andrew or is it Andy?
Oh, never Andy.
No. Never Andy, right.
I don't care. Call me whatever you want, but Andy's a very particular flavour, isn't it? There's yeah. Some people who lean heavily into Andy, and I'm not one of them.
Well, that's okay. I just won't call you that then.
I don't think I'm jocular enough. I don't think I'm popular enough to be an Andy. Like, you know, Andy McNab, there's a guy, you know, who you'd trust and who... Yeah. Andrew, you know.
Well, we'll leave it at Andrew. That's okay. Andrew, for anyone watching and listening, is the author of Before and After, a kind of apocalyptic novel that we'll discuss later on, as well as the founder of Man... Is it? Would you say Man V Fat or Man Versus Fat? What do you call it?
Yeah, people say either. I would say Man V Fat. But
okay, well, we'll call it Man V Fat, and I'll call you Andrew, and I won't make any naming mistakes. we'll get into both of them because they're interlinked and they're very interesting. So we'll get into that in a minute. But before we get into that, I'd like to kind of give us a bit of background of you growing up and how you became this person that had so many different skills and jobs and everything.
Okay, sure. So my background as such, I grew up in the Midlands. I was born in Stafford, a little village, well, city in the city. I think it's a town in the Midlands. And we moved a little bit around there. So, and then I went to school in Stoke and went to the University of Manchester. And really, it was sort of a relatively typical upbringing, I would say. I don't think there's anything necessarily noteworthy about my childhood as such. But books were a huge part of who I was and how I learned. We were talking about just briefly before we started this interview about 2000 AD. Yeah. And I sort of, in a rather glib way, said I think 2000 AD might have taught me to read. And I think that there is some truth in that, it was one of those moments in your reading career where you actually realize that stories have different levels. Yeah. So, you know, I think I'd always read 2000 AD, never quite understanding that it was a satire of authoritarianism and how, you know, Judge Dredd wasn't necessarily the perfect hero that I thought he was on first reading, and that actually there was something terrifying about him as well. Mm. And I think that some of the authors who took Judge Dredd on really brought that out in the most magnificent way, because on, you know, from cell to cell, you're either cheering him or fearing him and thinking, goodness me, what a horrific future there is in Mega City One. Yeah. For waiting there for us. So I think that, you know, that for me was a really formative reading experience, because the scales fell from my eyes and I was aware that there was depths in books. And then you go back, once that's been revealed to you once, you go back and you go,
yeah,
do you know what? I don't think Animal Farm was about people, about animals all sitting around the trough. I think there might have been something deeper there.
Maybe. And I think as well, it's always interesting when like everyone has that moment. It's very similar to the moment when you realize your parents are not perfect, that they're human, that they make mistakes. You know, it's like, you then go, oh, wait, and you reflect and you think of all the books you've read and you think of all the comics you've read and everything, and you kind of, yeah, you read everything again almost, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I think that, you know, that those two worlds obviously interlink when you realise that there are these depths. And I certainly, you know, I was a terrible, terrible student. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was deeply annoying, I'm sure, because, you know, I always used to get really good grades, but never really did any work. And I think when I look back on that now, it's with a sense of shame of the fact that what a wasted opportunity, that I could be so much smarter and know so much more. But actually, what I realized I was doing around things was that I was reading nonstop. You know, I would read often off the reading lists that were provided for GCSEs, A-levels and courses, but I didn't stop reading. So I had a very sort of broad knowledge base to draw from to answer questions and things. And yeah, that reading is a fundamental part of who I am and shaped me massively.
So if you're saying it shaped you massively, I mean, obviously 2000 AD Do you think there's one book from, we'd say, before you went to university, like either secondary school or primary school or even before, is there any one book that you can go like, that book shaped me, that book, there's something about that book that got to me?
Oh man, one book, that's painful.
Is there even one broad lesson you got from a multiple books that kind of, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, at the same time as kind of reading widely, I was also deeply pretentious in as a person and from what I read. So I often read books that made me look far smarter than I either was or felt.
Okay.
And so I remember touting around Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance by R.M. Persig at various points because it seemed like the sort of thing that was pretty cool, and you know, struggled through reading it and kind of got something out of it. I did actually read it, but you know, it was just that sense of reading for the sake of look at what I'm reading. See, the Kindle's buggered all of this because, you know, what's the point of reading all these pretentious books
if you can't show off all the covers?
Exactly. Yeah.
It's what I'm doing right now.
How are you supposed to impress people on the bus when, you know, your Kindle looks as utilitarian as everyone else's? You just have to talk into a mobile phone even louder and say, you'll have to excuse me, I'm reading R.M. Persig's Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
You're really reminding me of me when I was 16.
I think we were all this awful.
Yeah, yeah. For me, my Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was Clockwork Orange. That was my book that I was like, look how amazing I am. I'm reading Clockwork Orange.
And I read that on a train back from my granddad's funeral, and I remember the man on the table opposite me going, "You're very young to be reading Clockwork Orange," and me sort of preening and going, "Yes, I probably am. I'm probably a genius." What?
or the classic, "Well, I'm very mature for my age."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Do you mind? I'm 48.
Oh, okay.
No, so Zen the Art Motorcycle Maintenance, just for the sheer sort of pretension of it. But the kind of one that I think, I was really into William Burroughs for a long time. So Naked Lunch, but also a lot of his letters. I really preferred, he did a published book of his letters. And that really made an impact on me because it spoke about the writer's life and about what writing was like. And I had these sort of great ideas about what writing was like. And Burroughs was really quite brutal in his honesty around how poor he was, how miserable he was. I mean, you know, he had endless sex and drugs, so he seemed like he was living a life, but he was just, you know, he had to keep moving to shittier and shittier countries because he was just so poor, basically. And then, you know, things
poor when it came to money, but I mean, he was rich in other ways, it seems.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So that was really, and Hunter S. Thompson for the similar reasons. You know, I really enjoyed his letters, possibly more than I enjoyed his novels. And On the Road by Jack Kerouac. That was just another book that really stuck with me. And probably the one that shaped me personally in terms of my own style was Of Mice and Men by Steinbeck. Just because I love that relationship. And that sort of that fraternal style relationship, which was something I think I felt like I lacked. But it really resonated with me, this sort of that the strength and the beauty of that relationship. And I think, you know, and probably more than any book, that destroys me. You know, even if I see it replicated in Bugs Bunny cartoons these days, you know, where you see it parodied, it still makes me cry. It's awful.
Yeah. Speaking of just as you were saying earlier about the scales falling from your eyes and looking back, geez, those Looney Tunes cartoons like Bugs Bunny, they had some fantastic references that and operatic music as well, that just as a kid when you're watching it going, "Ha ha, you hit him in the head," like, you know. Like they were hitting you on the head with classical references to really important stuff, you know?
All the way through, exactly. Yeah. And So it's quite funny because I've got a 3-year-old daughter. I've got two sons as well and a 3-year-old daughter. And we watch Tom and Jerry. And I think it's really interesting. You know, you can probably see where you are on the cynicism cycle about how you relate to Tom and Jerry, because obviously you watch it as a kid and it's just really funny.
Jerry, you're rooting for Jerry.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you go to phase, where you're going, man, Tom has it really tough. Sympathizing with him and thinking, there's thousands of mice. If he could just eat Jerry once, and, you know, hoping for it. And now I'm back in the kind of the slapstick just kills me.
Yeah.
Just seeing, like, you know, Tom hit into a big sort of bowl of bubble gum and his eyes going different colors because of the different bubble. It's just, oh man, sublime. So I think, but I'm waiting for my second teenagerhood, really, in probably my late 40s, early 50s, where I'll start going, oh, how repulsive.
Slapstick. So you seem to have a big a love for stories of all kinds, maybe comic books or slapstick cartoons and all the books you've read. So when you were younger, like, were you ever into telling stories and writing your own, or is that something that just came after your career in journalism?
First of all, I need you to spell the word "grow" for me.
Oh, okay. It's it has a letter that doesn't exist in English, so G-R and then A father, which is an A but with a little flick on the top.
A father. Grow. And grow is love.
It's one of the loves. There's loads of, there's like multiple words. So like grow is if you have a grow for something, it's you're passionate and you care about it.
Like a burning.
Yeah, and you can be, you see, we don't even say, you can say Tom and Graw that, which is I'm in love with you, but that'd be more a lust kind of a love, whereas it's even Lum who would be the kind of more nurturing kind of caring love.
Amazing.
Anyway, this suddenly becomes an Irish topic. So
it's no bad thing. It's fascinating. So Graw, thank you. That's a great word. For me, stories, I think, I remember writing from a very early age and, you know, wanting to reshape the world through my experience and my experiences of the world through what I wrote down. And yeah, I think I was just always that way inclined, you know. It's difficult to say whether you think that can you make a writer, or is there just that natural tendency to write? And I think for me, it was always just a love of words. And, you know, even now when I hear interesting, fascinating words, it's I want to know them and I want to soak them up, so that, because when you have a developed vocabulary and you have an ability to wield that, I don't think there's anything more, I don't think there's anything sexier. I don't think there's anything more powerful. I don't think there's anything more wonderful to see than someone with a rich command of their language using it to its fullest extent. It's devastating. It can be, you know, it can result in absolute hilarity. It can result in sheer brutality. But it's always just a joy to watch. And I think for me, I think the first time I remember writing a story was when we used to go up and see my grandparents in Edinburgh. And, you know, for a kid, when you're driving on the motorway, it's just endless. And so as you look at the beautiful hills out the window,
The hills back home.
Marginally bigger, great. And so just through that sheer boredom and wanting to write. So I remember just filling up exercise book after exercise book and thinking that was wonderful. And I think I was always like that. I kept diaries when I was a teenager, which were obviously read by parents and things like that. And it was just a natural instinct in me to put things down, to try and write and to try and express myself in that way. And I think it's partly because I often felt more fluent in the written form. You know, I like talking to people, I like expressing myself verbally, but I feel like you can reach the, some people, you know, you listen to Stephen Fry, Will Self, people like that, and they can express themselves absolutely pinpoint accuracy as they're talking. And that's amazing. That's just, you know, what a skill. But I feel like I can only come near to that level of fluency and that articulacy when I'm writing, because I need to stop. I need to check the reference, which I would have casually just thrown off the top of my head. And then, you know, 40 minutes later, realize it wasn't Steinbeck. It was actually, you know, it was Orwell or something. And so I feel like that's where I have my confidence in writing. If I can sit and create a piece of written work, and also, you know, you can shave away the bits that you don't want and the bits that don't. After having been a journalist, I've been a journalist for over 20 years.
Yeah.
And through doing that, through a daily process of writing and shaping words and getting things in on time and then being shouted at for, you know, the weakness of your language and the possible legal implications of your rusty, you know, links and things like that. It's, you learn to shape language, and that's where I feel most comfortable, is in sitting in front of a computer and writing a passage of text.
Seeing as you mentioned the your work in journalism, and I think it's a good point, because I think now in like, we're recording this November 2020, and with Trumpism in the US, and you have Brexit as well over in your part of the world, in the UK, I mean, it just shows the power of using particular it shows the power of journalism, whether for ill or for good, I think. And we won't get too much into Brexit and Trump, because God knows that could be, that could be 10 episodes of a podcast. I might get you back on, maybe, who knows. No, I think you're right. And I think language is so important to have the right words. And you reminded me as well of my, I'm a primary teacher, and in a child psychology lecture, there was a man, what was his name? Mark Morgan was the lecturer. And he said that above all the subjects that we teach in school in Ireland, English was the most important. Because if a child doesn't have the language to express themselves properly, then they can't. And then if they can't, that leads to psychological issues, you know, further down the line. And which, seeing as you mentioned Orwell, is the whole point of 1984, to, if they have edited out so many words, like, there's no such thing as brilliant, it's double plus good. It's to suppress people and all that kind of thing. So
And it's about the control, isn't it, that you can exert through language. And I think the other thing, you know, just pulling in the point of Trumpism as well, is that, you know, the thing that we've grown inured to in many ways is that language is magic, and the expression of language is the fundamental essence of magic. So, you know, in the fantasy world, magic is when a wizard uses, or, you know, a sorcerer uses a spell to a set of words, which then have an impact on the world.
Yeah.
So it might be that their spell is, you know, to cast a fireball or something like that. So, okay, so we don't have those direct sources of language, although I would argue through computer language, we do have those sorts of things, you know, through computer language. I won't do it because it'll actually switch this off. But, you know, if I ask my assistant, my Google assistant, to do something for me in the room, you know, if I wanted to switch on my light bulb, then it will do that. So I would argue that through language and through computer language, we've created a situation where we can have this incredibly direct impact on our world, but also through a broader sense as well. If we want people to experience things, so I think I said before about the fact that if you want people to laugh, or if you want people to cry, or if you want people to change their mind, the way that we can do that is through the eloquent expression of language.
Yeah.
So how is that not magic?
Yeah.
I just, you know, don't see the difference between the two, other than that one uses, you know, nonsense, often Latinesque phrases.
Exactly. So how did you get started in journalism? Like, was it something you went straight into after university, or was it kind of something you stumbled into?
It was something I stumbled into, really, because during university I wrote for the student newspaper. Actually, as is typical for me, I came to it very late. It was just after I graduated that I started writing for the student newspaper.
Which
sounds kind of weird, because obviously you should be a student, but I think they wanted to do a series about people who just graduated. And so I started writing for the student newspaper, and just really found it thrilling to have something that you wrote. You know, you could occasionally see people, this was in the days of far more printed media, obviously, but you know, you could see people on the bus reading the student newspaper, and they turn over and see your column and then flick past it, obviously. But, you know, there was still that subliminal moment where they could have impacted, you could have impacted on them. And it was just, it was really a eureka moment for me, really, that this was an immediate way for me. I knew that I wanted to write fiction ultimately, but I think I was very aware that that was a tough slog. Whereas writing for the newspapers and writing for magazines was a way that you could get paid, and B, a way that you could very quickly learn to write on a, you know, it's becoming a professional writer. So if nothing else, I believe that I'm a professional writer, someone who can respond to a brief and, you know, turn in 2,000 words tomorrow on pretty much any subject that you care to give me. And that was really what taught me. So from there, I started working for a publishing company in Manchester who did a lot of magazines and products for graduates and students. So if you ever went into your careers library or careers office while you're at university, then all of the publications and the magazines that they did there were from a company called Graduate Prospects. And that's the company that I worked for. And they were really, really good at developing. They had, you know, they published an awful lot of magazines, and so they needed journalists and editors. So I started as an editor and as a journalist, well, as a journalist, but also functioned as an editor on some of the other publications. And that was a really, really valuable learning experience, because not only was I churning out my own copy, I was also reading other people's.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're getting both sides of it, aren't you? Because not only are you doing your own, you're also correcting others. So there's something I keep saying, that I'm in a writing group and we meet once a month, and I learn 70% of what I learn from that group is reading other people's stuff and seeing, oh wow, there's something. Do I have that same issue, or do I make that same mistake in my own writing? And it kind of,
absolutely. And that's it's formative. It's, you know, it's so useful. And for anyone who you know, younger people who are potentially looking at writing, who are listening to this, absolutely get yourself into a situation where you can correct other people's work. And funnily enough, you know, that there's an awful lot of work out there for it at the moment, because if you offer work as a proofreader, often, you know, people are more than happy to have you proofread their work. Mm. And it gives you that experience of going into a malleable page of text with someone else's work and shaping it and seeing what happens if you pull out that paragraph and if you pull that out. And I think probably, arguably, my skills are greater in terms of editing and rewriting than they possibly are in writing. So, okay, you know, I feel very confident when it comes to having a block of text and being able to shape that. And I'm still assailed by doubt and worry when it comes to actually putting that text onto the page.
Aren't we all?
so us.
There's one tiny thing you mentioned on your on your profile on your Amazon author page that I just have to get more info. Said,
I know what this is about.
I'm reading. You know what's coming, but people listen. Yeah. So you said you wrote an article or something about which injury hurts the most. An article for a children's science magazine, which received more complaints than any article they'd ever run. So,
yeah.
Huh? What? Why?
Tell more. So what it was that there was this great children's science magazine that used to be available in newsagents before newsagents stopped selling magazines and you know, it being a profitable business model. But it was a really cool magazine because basically what you realize when you write for this, I'm not a science specialist, but, you know, it was for children. So therefore I'm smarter than kids, broadly speaking. So therefore I was qualified. And it was amazing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was really cool because you realized what it was that your readership wanted, and what children want is just the grossest, bleakest, yeah, darkest, snottiest. You're a primary school teacher, so you get this every single day.
I mean, there's a reason Horrible Histories, I'm sure you know that series of books, like,
yeah,
they skyrocketed in sales when they first came out in the 90s because it did have all the gross things, and
yeah,
it's for that reason. But anyway, sorry.
And also, you know, I think there's that sort of slightly Victorian sensibility about protecting children through not telling them about death and about what happens when, you know, but kids love that stuff.
Oh yeah.
You know, as long as you talk to them about it in a moderated and open way, where they can ask questions and process things. Often the questions that they will ask are pretty bleak. And it takes you to difficult places because you're working off your instincts of, I didn't think this was a child-friendly conversation. But actually, all conversations are child-friendly conversations, provided you have them in a sensible enough way.
Sorry to cut across you, but there's your point about language and the strength and the ability of it, because I agree with you. I think maybe not every conversation is child-friendly, but every topic can be child-friendly. And you just have to use the correct language that both teaches or explains that topic, but at the same time doesn't overwhelm them or introduce them to concepts they're not ready for. So it's all about using the correct
language. I think that's true. But then, I mean, you're sort of aware that, you know, child abuse is a thing that happens in this world. And I'm not saying that, you know, all conversations are about child abuse, but so therefore, that being the case, you realize that you have to have that conversation with some children.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, how on earth do you help them process that sort of reality? You know, so when the world thrusts horrific adult concepts onto children, like, you know, death, poverty, hunger, you know, abuse, those are things that children do experience and experience in far, far greater numbers than we would ever be comfortable admitting. And I think that when you see that, you realize that actually, well, children need support in those conversations, and, you know, clearly you wouldn't just go in and start talking about those things.
Yeah.
But I think we have to be open to the fact that the world often throws some pretty horrific things at kids, and therefore we have to acknowledge that. And maybe, you know, to some extent, things like Horrible Histories is closer to acknowledging those sorts of things than we would often like to admit. And so this particular magazine really, oh, yes,
to get back to what my actual
yeah, just skip back to
we're
that.
Both at fault.
The, you know, from that was a really instructive thing to have a readership like that and to see what it was. So I wrote a thing about when dogs kill themselves. Because and that was based off a question from one of the readers. Do dogs ever kill themselves? And the editor was like, oh, man, that's a great question. Do they?
Yeah.
So I went and yeah, they do occasionally. Not sort of knowingly, but anyway.
Yeah.
And there's a bridge in Scotland where more dogs have plummeted to their death than anywhere else on earth. Yeah. But this particular article was about what hurts the most.
Okay.
And so this was something I pitched, which was, you know, kids love injuries and accidents and things like that. And so as a result, I spoke to a number of different medical professionals, from neurologists, A&E doctors, you know, all sorts of people, and asked them, you know, in your professional opinion, what hurts the most? And they all came back with these really gross things like, well, inflamed kidney stones and, you know, all these things. But this A&E doctor won, because he said that, I can't remember if he'd actually treated him or it was someone that he knew had treated him. So I hope it never proves apocryphal, but he said it was a rugby player who fell badly during a tackle. And as he fell badly, he dislocated his hip. Ooh, painful, right?
Okay.
Not even the start of it. So the first aider comes on and relocates his hip, feeling like, you know, he's doing him a favour. And the guy starts screaming even more as he's relocated his hip. And he says, why, what's, you know, they try and work out what's going on. And this guy, he's screaming so much, he bursts his vocal cords. So he's just sort of like, not even making any noise as he's screaming. And what they realized was that they'd trapped his testicular nerve into the ball and socket. And it sort of clunked back in. Testicular nerve is in there. And so when he even, that's not even the end of it, is it? Because when he gets to hospital and they figure that out, they've got to pull his bloody leg out again. I know. There's not enough morphine in the world, really, is there?
I need morphine now. Holy. Oh, wow. That's so you've put that in a kids' magazine then.
Yeah, and they got loads of complaints. Go figure.
Well, I mean, you answered the question. It was like, what else are you supposed to do, you know?
Exactly. I'm a reporter. I don't make it up. I just tell people what people have told me.
So as you're a journalist, I need to move on because that's scaring me. Anyway, as you're working as a journalist, I know you ended up being a food writer and being a restaurant critic. And then over time, that kind of developed and affected you physically.
I mean, from working as a food writer was just a real privilege, and it was a very interesting view into a sort of a field of life that I'd never necessarily seen before. So, you know, I'd never eaten a Michelin star restaurant before I started working as a food writer. And it was really, really fascinating to see how quickly your standards and your expectations rise to that level. That's of
skyrocket. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then you're walking into your local harvester going, oh God, they're not even doing a crumb sweep. You become this absolute monster. It does actually change the way that you enjoy eating out, because it becomes, you find yourself. So I was a restaurant critic for the Metro. I reviewed for the AA Guide and for a number of different places. I won a competition for best young restaurant critic and things like that. And so it was a really fun thing to do. But I always came at it from the point of view of, I have no experience of this. Because my broad general view was that 70-80% of the country have probably never set foot in a Michelin star restaurant before.
Yeah.
And actually a good proportion of those people are probably terrified of doing so, because God alone knows I was. And one thing I've never been frightened of is just wearing my idiocy as a sort of shield and going in and asking stupid questions and not really caring if people went, who's that twat? You know, it's just sort of par for the course. So that was really good. The obvious consequence of people inviting you out to eat and to drink was that I ate and drank a lot and got incredibly fat as a result. And my weight had always fluctuated and has always fluctuated through my life. And it was, I think, you know, during that period, I was probably 4 or 5 stone heavier than I am now. So I was probably about 18, 19 stone.
Okay.
And, you know, just desperately unhappy with where I was. And there was a lot of things going on at the time. So I'd started a business supporting men who were getting married. So I did, we did a lot of writing about wedding speeches and best men, father of the bride, that sort of thing. And I just sold that business and I was working stupidly long hours. I was stressed and I was pretty miserable in truth, because I was just sort of consumed by work. And I'd really let my sort of weight balloon. And it was really difficult for me at that point, because I wanted to lose weight and just didn't feel like there was any support out there really.
Okay. And that's what ended up becoming Man Versus Fat, because I was reading on the about page of that you kind of went to, you went to explore losing your weight and becoming healthier, but that most of the things out there were, would you say it's fair to say they're aimed at women, or it's just that it was mostly women that went to these things? What do you think it is? Like, I'm talking the likes of Weight Watchers, Slimming World, you know.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. It's sort of a chicken and egg question in some ways. Was it targeted at women and therefore only women went? I think it's probably broadly true, because if you look back to the formation of some of the earlier organizations like Weight Watchers, you know, they were sold and marketed through almost like Tupperware party style deals in the 1960s in America, where it was, you know, the women got together to talk and to have social interaction, but the kind of the purpose or the meta purpose of that meeting was weight. And so people who felt that they needed to lose weight, and clearly these were operated, you know, we're talking back in the 1960s, where men were away at work, and you could almost see that that was a divergent point for culture, because this was where weight, fat, the diet industry became a female entity. It became a feminine issue. And so, you know,
even weight and dieting and that kind of thing even started in the 60s, because up until then, I mean, like back the 50s, people were just recovering from World War II. You know, like there were definitely people that had weight issues in those times, but not to the extent that there is now. Or, you know, so I'd say it's kind of a thing of, it both started in the 60s and also started aiming at women in the 60s, you can really say.
Undoubtedly, yeah. And I think that's a really interesting sociological point about the fact that, you know, from in the 1960s and the 1970s, fat was almost sort of like this sort of almost a point of pride in some ways. Yeah. Because if you go back to a very short period before, so the 1950s, 1940s, so where these people's parents would have been influencing them, you know, the fat wasn't an option. They worked in primarily manual jobs, or jobs that required them to be on their feet. Car use was so much lower, so walking and cycling was so much more prevalent. And the abundance of calorie-rich food just wasn't there. So, yeah, as you go into the 60s and 70s, it almost wasn't a shameful, oh, gosh, I'm so fat sort of issue.
Yeah.
It was, oh, yeah, I could stand to lose a few pounds, check me out sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't ever that overt, but I think that there was definitely that sort of that issue. And so, you know, you fast forward through the decades, and you can see why weight and fat skipped men, and why it's codified in many different ways for men as almost being a positive. Mm-hmm. So you had these situations where, you know, there were Hollywood stars who were male who were larger.
Yeah.
And yes, you know, some of them were in comic roles, but not all of them. You know, and so there were still these people who men could identify with, and still to this day, you know, we have people joining up with Man Be Fat who say, I don't want to become thin, because thin is seen as weak.
Yeah.
And actually we have just as many, well, we have a number of men who come to us and say, actually, my battle with weight is putting it on. Because men who genetically are often quite thin sometimes feel dreadful about that, because they feel that that leaves them weaker and less important, and that they're pilloried for that. I mean, God, what a world. But, you know,
it's you're either, you don't have enough weight or you're too much of it. And that seems to be the line in the sand, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it's, you know, but I think through my own experience of kind of feeling really, really miserable with my weight. So Man V Fat started in 2014 when I kind of started to lose weight. And I've said this a few times, but genuinely, this is a true story. I went to Weight Watchers and was the sole bloke lurking in the back of the class, in like, you know, a total freak. And in this particular class, the leader said, and we were talking about, you know, your weight during your period and, you know, how it can fluctuate. And so don't worry, girls, if you're kind of a pound on, a pound off during your you know, if you're menstruating. I was like, that just isn't my problem.
What about me? Why is my weight fluctuating?
If I get my period, I'm going to hospital. And it's just that sense of... they weren't covering the topics that I knew were important for men, which were, you know, I was working far, far too long hours. I was, you know, that meant that at points I was having to eat from service stations and there was no healthy food there. What do you eat if you're going to go to a service station and eat healthily? You know, there's a question. And there are all these sorts of things where, and how do I fight against the fact that my mates, if I tell them I'm on a diet, they're going to say, come on, come for a curry, fat arsehole, come on, it doesn't matter, let's go for a pint. And, you know, the role of alcohol in men's lives, those sorts of things. You know, so it felt to me like weight needed a gendered answer because you needed to be able to say, and also the other thing as well is that men are very, very, find it difficult if they are in mixed gender groups when it comes to weight loss. So... that it's difficult because some of them clam up and don't want to talk about the things that they found difficult. And so when we started Man V Fat, there was just this real rush of agreement that this was something that needed to, you know, to exist.
Yeah.
And I'd started the crowdfunding campaign on the lines of, is it just me who feels this way? And we had 3,000 guys who signed up in the period of that crowdfunding campaign. It got shared by things like people like Jamie Oliver and the British Obesity Society. And there just seemed to be this real upswell of support for it as a something that needed to exist. And very fortunately, that's never really stopped, really. I mean, I say very fortunately, but at the same time, I wish that wasn't true. It's one of those businesses that you really... you wish that you could go out of business because ultimately, you know, it's not a nice.
You set it up because there's an issue and you'd rather the issue wasn't there.
Totally.
While it is there, here's one of the solutions. And that's one thing I'm really interested in is you said you look at Man V Fat as a gendered answer to weight loss. And I know that there's some people out there that are listening, and even there's a part of me that's going, no, you can't have an exclusive thing gender-wise. But it's I suppose from my understanding about Man V Fat isn't necessarily exclusive. It's more including those that were already excluded. It's which is weird for like for men to say, well, actually, we're in this realm, we're the downtrodden ones. so
yeah.
What is it that Man V Fat does to gender weight loss? Like what is it? What are the kind of key things? Is it just even the fact that it's just a room of men talking about their weight, or is there other steps and actions that you take?
Yeah. I mean, it's, there's a number of things really. I think that I do still believe strongly that there needs to be a gendered approach to weight loss. Because I still believe that the different... So, I mean, you could go from a simple biological truth, which is that men carry more muscle than women biologically. So that is not a sort of controversial statement. That's just a biological truth. And as a result of that, men's metabolism tends to be higher. So if men start dieting, they tend to lose weight quicker than women.
Yeah.
And if you put all of those people in the same room, so if you put men and women in the same room and say you are on a weight loss journey together, often the men will outperform the women. If then the men stay, you know, arguing that, you know, everyone aim and does actually stay the course of the program, men will nearly always outperform women because they will burn calories at a higher rate.
Yeah.
So even just that, let's say, for example, so Slimming World used to do this fruit basket per week for the Biggest Loser. So, you know, if the one bloke, Barry, at the back of the class, who's got, you know, is 19 stone, needs to be 14. If he's on it, he's going to win the fruit basket every week. And the women are going to hate him for the fact that he's taking them the fruit basket. And it's not the fact that, you know, it's just the fact that there is a difference between them.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, that's a quite a trite point, but it's
a very basic one. And not only that, I mean, if you are the only man in a Slimming World class or Weightless World class or Weight Watchers class or whatever, yeah, and you are losing it faster, apart from the fact that you're the only man there, feeling ostracized and feeling different, if you're accelerating and causing feelings of jealousy amongst the people that are there with you, that's going to make that worse. So
yeah, absolutely. So, and that actually points towards one of the things that we did to look at supporting men, which is the fact that men are often quite competitive. So if you can harness that competitiveness and direct it towards weight loss in a healthy way, obviously, but you know, you can actually do tremendous things. So for, I created this thing called Man V Fat for Football, which is
read about this. This is, I love this idea.
So there's so what it is, it's for football leagues, for so small sided football leagues, so 5, 6, 7 aside football leagues, exclusively for overweight and obese men. And what happens is that all of the men weigh in before they play their game. They're put into teams, put into leagues, like a normal sort of 5-a-side football league sort of setup, but they weigh in beforehand. And as a result of their weight loss per week, they add goals to their team's performance that week. So we often have situations where teams will go out and get absolutely thrashed on the pitch, but they will win because when you add in the weight loss goals, they've lost, you know, it's not just on the amount of weight lost, it's on things like consistency of weight loss. So for example, a player can score a hat trick by losing weight 3 weeks in a row.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be, you know, a certain amount. It just has to be a weight loss each week. And, you know, again, that's a way of gamifying and harnessing that psychological approach that men sometimes have. And also it made it a lot easier to market because men were saying to their mates, I'm joining this football league. And that didn't sound as weird as saying I'm joining this weight loss program.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact, but then because it was very overtly Man V Fat football, you know, it was about being fat. It almost becomes this sort of source of, well, I'm joining it because I need to lose weight. You know, we're not hiding that fact. It is, but what we are doing is that we are structurally creating this where it is you versus fat. So it's you versus this problem.
Yeah.
And the football is just sort of a
fun way to
separate. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think even the name Man V Fat, I think it's cleverly named because it's very blunt. And it just, like Slimming World, Weight Watchers, they're very kind of welcoming and calming and listen, don't worry, it's okay.
It's not even Weight Watchers anymore, it's WW.
Even that, like it's even kind of hiding, well, not hiding what it is, like everyone knows, but, and there's nothing wrong with that because I do think there is, like, I mean, we're talking about the gender differences of weight problems. I think, like you were saying, men are kind of don't want to get thin, but equally women are consistently, constantly barraged from a very young age about their appearance, with the weight being one of the things of the appearance. So you can kind of understand why these programs are more welcoming for women with those names, even just because it's less you're fat. Whereas with the men, I think the word the verses in it is key from my understanding of it, because it's, oh right, I'm gonna go beat this thing, I'm gonna go win, I'm gonna da 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 da, and gamifying it kind of taps into the sometimes negative aspect of a lot of men of being very competitive. It's very interesting, because it's something that I have never really thought deeply about, and then researching for this, I'm like, whoa, there's actually so much here.
And I mean, I think the thing that I often thought when it came to Man v Fat was that, you know, people talk about with businesses, what's your niche?
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, who's your audience for this? Well, you know, where's your niche?
And you're like, for me, in the name.
Yeah, exactly. But for me, niche always implied like a narrow proportion of something. I mean, I'd have to get the dictionary to look at the exact meaning of it, but I'm sure it's a slice. It's a, you know, it's a kind of a part of a whole. And the thing that really struck me about Man v Fat was how much of a problem weight is in our society. So, you know, you look at men, and I think, you know, this figures might be a little bit outdated now, but it was around about 28 million men in the UK are either overweight or obese. And it's 7 out of 10 men who are overweight or obese. So, yeah, for me, that was the real surprise, was seeing sort of how prevalent this was as a problem. And therefore, and I don't think that that's still acknowledged fully from a society point of view. I think that we still think that weight is just this sort of funny little side issue, when it's not. It's something that, and, you know, people experience that problem to a greater or lesser degree. You know, for me, it was a real problem and has been a lifelong yo-yoing battle. But equally, for some people, it's genuinely miserable. And that's kind of where before and after came out of.
Yeah. And that's good. Look at this. You know how to segue. Like, you're doing all the segues for me. I kind of feel like I just sit back and let you go. So that's what I wanted to ask, because you're right. It is about the fact that it's not really spoken about. And one thing that you said in the when we were first connecting about this was that before and after, which I'll get you to speak about it in a minute, the main character is, I think it's safe to say obese, not overweight.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you said, it's not just a cosmetic thing that's added in. It's actually integral to the story and the plot and the character's journey. So can you tell us a bit about before and after?
Yeah, sure. So from a blurb point of view, before and after is the story of Ben Stone, who weighs 601 pounds. So as you say, absolutely obese, category 3, I think that would be, for the height that he's at. And he's diabetic. He needs an operation to amputate his leg. And he's been a shut-in for 9 years in his flat, fourth floor flat in a block of flats. And the book starts when the council comes to take the front of his flat off so that a crane can take him out of his flat, because he can't safely use the stairs or the lift. And he's going to be craned out of his flat. And he's kind of wrapped up and, you know, made safe for this journey. And at that point, the world ends. And so it's the story really starts when, you know, he's just on the verge of leaving the flat for the first time. And, you know, in a very 2020 way, the story is primarily about someone who is stuck in his home watching a pandemic rage outside his window. And that is, in a nutshell, is what the book's about.
And it's such an interesting story, because, of course, like, it's something we've seen and heard a lot. I don't want to say in the news, but I feel like there was a point in time, like the late 90s to the mid to late 2000s, where, like, it'd be an E4 or a Channel 4 thing, where there'd be this kind of documentary or investigative kind of report or something on someone like that, on Sorry, what was the main character's first name again? Sorry.
Ben Stone. Ben.
Ben. So, like, on someone like Ben, that while they're so big and they're so obese, they actually have to be lifted by a crane or by construction work kind of stuff. And yeah, it's something that has kind of faded from mainstream media a little bit, that particular type of obesity. And it's interesting to see it come back in your book. What was it? I mean, obviously you had your, you had Man Be Fat behind you at this stage when you were, not behind you, but like it was well and truly running at this stage. So what was it, apart from Man versus Fat, what was it that made you think of Ben as a character and of how to put him in the situation you put him in?
I think the, there's a couple of things there. For me, where did he come from? I'd had several conversations and I'd interviewed, you know, over 1,000 guys through doing Man Be Fat who were losing weight or wanted to lose weight or had successfully lost weight. Mm. And I'd interviewed a number of what are called shut-ins, where people don't leave the house because of their weight. And often, you know, that's a combination of either physically they can't leave the house because their mobility is severely restricted. You know, obviously, once you reach a weight of that sort of level, the danger is if you fall over, there is a really, it's a problem to get back on your feet. And that often results in injury. So nervousness can result about sort of leaving the house. But often as well, there is real mental health problems associated with why they've gained that weight and where that has come from. Mm. And I think for me, you know, it was such a, those conversations were really difficult and they were really tragic. And I felt that, but I also really, really saw and feel the true humanity of those of people, because, you know, it's so easy to look at someone who's overweight or obese and say, just see them as that weight problem. And, you know, there are countless surveys and studies that show that people naturally think that people who are overweight are poorer, more stupid, of a lower socioeconomic group, less educated. You know, all of these things, that the assumptions that we make of someone.
Negative assumptions as well.
Hugely, yeah. And as I say, you then go back to this idea that actually this is 70% of the male population who are overweight or obese. So why are we not seeing the other side of that, this sort of this more human side of things about men and weight? And so that struck me that it was a really, I think the original one line idea was what would happen to a shut in at the end of the world. Mm-hmm. And I think it was really just an extrapolation of that. Yeah, that's an interesting idea, because, you know, often in post-apocalyptic novels, there's this great journey that they undertake from one side of the coast of America to the other to deliver.
Yeah, it's always America, isn't it?
Yeah, always. Yeah, exactly. So this one is proudly set in Middleton in North Manchester. And it's, you know, and I felt that that was missing a trick, really. And it was a useful story device to put this at the end of the world, because we have expectations of what those stories include. Mm. And to put someone who is so profoundly not usually seen in an apocalyptic story
like that. Yeah,
it just struck me as a really interesting way. And I think the British Obesity Society reviewed the book and were very kind about it, and they struck the nail on the head for me, which is that they said that it was you know, it was a profound horror story. And the worst part is that, the you know, so much of it is real. And I think, you know, once you take away the more dramatic elements of the end of the world, you know, a lot of the story of Ben is about his, you know, how he gained weight and why he was in that situation and how he felt about his body. And I think that is where a lot of the true horror comes in.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure a lot of the men that you've helped through Man Be Fat really kind of, I'm sure that book resonated with them. And I'm sure there's other men and women, of course, that have read it and it resonates them with at the start of their journey. So that's something I think is really interesting about the book, because it's like I said, like the two of us were saying, it's not a physical character that you would see often in any book, really. And if it is in a book, it's unfortunately usually for a comic relief, or it's something that isn't quite respectful of the humanity that is in that person. And it's, I mean, you said that, you know. I'm aware we're running swiftly over the time that I said we'd be. So sure. I'm going to skip towards my end section, the same few questions, so I'm not keeping you for too long. So when we're done with this interview, what's the first thing you're going to do this evening?
This evening? So I'm going to go and take my dog out for a wee. Because it's all glamour here, Connor.
Oh, well, it's all glamour everywhere. I have to do the same thing, so it's fine.
What's your dog called?
My dog is Willow. And Willow. She's driving my boyfriend up the wall in the other room because he's trying to keep her quiet.
What sort of dog is it?
Pardon?
What sort of dog is it?
She's a Cabochon. So tiny little white fluff ball. She's a half Cavalier King Charles, half Bichon Frise.
Cabochon,
yes.
Yeah.
So what
are you going to do? Oh, you're taking the dog out for a wee, yeah.
Apparently. Yeah. It's, as we said, very glamorous. The life of an indie author podcaster.
Exactly, yeah.
Do you have any other goals in the future regards writing, and then any goals that are nothing to do with writing?
Yeah, okay. A goal to do with writing is that one day I would like to feel like a writer. And I think that probably a lot of writers would say, well, that's what a writer feels like, is that you never feel like sort of authentic. I mean, my eye has been caught several times by the Hugh Harry trilogy to the left of you.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's profound, isn't it, how different you imagine writers feel. So, like, you know, if I'd written that trilogy, a wonderful trilogy which everyone should read, you would go to bed every night going, I'm a great writer, I'm really good at writing, I have no doubt about my writing ability. But I'd be willing to put words in Hugh Harry's mouth and say, I bet at times he goes, oh, I can never put another word on a page again because I suck so awfully. And I think that, you know, as much, all I've really learned about that sort of feeling of, you know, just being a gross imposter, is that the very most, that at least that's what everyone else feels like. What a terrible psychological impairment wanting to be a writer is, honestly. No wonder so many of us drink ourselves to death or shoot ourselves.
This public service announcement has been brought to you by Andrew Shanahan and Story of a Storyteller. non-writing goal.
I'd like to have the COVID vaccine.
Oh, wouldn't we all?
Really? And do you know what? Like, just from the point of view, like,
You're not the first person I've interviewed for this season of the podcast that said that was their goal.
Really, yeah. And it's like, it's just so that I can shut my brain up about it and just get on to thinking about other things. Like, I think that's what everyone feels like, is that, you know, I honestly think that's why Donald Trump lost as well, is that everyone just felt like they had uttered the word Trump and written the word Trump and read the word Trump so as many times as that they could possibly do, and that they'd had a surfeit of it and wanted something different. And that's how I feel about this year, is that I would just like to move on and be able to focus my brain on my next book and, you know,
other and move things. On.
Yeah.
Just move on. Like, it's been a, I don't think there's a single person in the year that this year hasn't affected negatively or been a bit traumatic. I feel is a very extreme word, and for some people it has been traumatic, but it's been a slog and it's been difficult, and we all just want to move on. So this is going to be releasing in 2021. So hopefully Everyone will be listening going, oh yeah, I remember that. That was, yeah, that's done.
I'm gonna comment under the video and say, yeah, I've had my vaccine now. I'm feeling
good. My last three questions, and they're very short and easy, is one, where can people find you online and find Man V Fat and find before and after?
Okay, so they can find me online. Probably the easiest thing to do is go to my blog, which is helloshan.co.uk. So Shan, S-H-A-N. And they can find the book at helpbiscuits.com. And that's H-E-L-P-B-I-S-C-U-I-T-S. I always worry that I'm going to misspell biscuits, but it's just biscuits. Helpbiscuits.com. And that should take you to the Amazon store for your geographic location. And Man V Fat is just manvfat.com.
Perfect. Brilliant. My last question, I said three, but I actually can't count. My last question is, what was the last book you read?
Skip the last one that I read because it's embarrassingly awful. I tend to read, I struggle with when I'm writing, I tend to read things that I could never even dream of writing. Okay. So I read a lot of detective fiction because I don't think I'm ever going to write a detective book because they're so intricate and you have to be really quite sort of, it's like building a clock or something, all of those cogs fitting together. And it's only when a master does it that you see how perfectly they all interlink. And so I read, I think it was a Sarah Paretsky, the Iva Shorsky book I've just finished. But I am reading Under the Dome by Stephen King.
Very good. Very good.
You read it?
No, I haven't read it, but I feel like I have two to be read lists. One is all the books in the world, and the other one is all Stephen King's books, which I feel are an equal amount. Because I don't understand how that man could, like, I've read his book on writing, so I do understand how he writes so much, but I don't understand how he writes so much.
Yeah, I mean, prolific doesn't even begin to cover it. And also, they're like serious chunky books as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's
when you're reading it on Kindle and you're constantly turning pages and you're like, I'm from 12% to like 13% over 3 hours.
Yeah.
How long is this book? And then you see that when it was released as like 8 paperback books.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's impressive, but it's nuts.
Yes.
Andrew, it's been a real pleasure having you on, and thank you so much. Sweet. I feel like we could talk for 2-3 more hours easily and we wouldn't be running out of topics, so I must get you on again in the future. Oh no.
So,
oh, there you are. You're back. God. Yeah,
the video is obviously conking out because we've been talking too long. But yeah, Connor, it's been great talking to you too. And thanks ever so much for having me on.
Not at all.
Thank you so much yet once again to Andrew for coming onto the show. And a little bit of something exciting. So I record these interviews well before they air, and then just before I record this intro and outro, I contact the guests and be like, hey, any updates, anything you want me to include? And there is a link in the show notes to Andrew's blog post about this, if you don't believe me. But somebody has approached Andrew about his book Before and After, asking if they could begin the process of adapting it to be a film, which is just amazing and well deserved. I mean, it's doing so well sales wise and reviews and everything. It seems to be a fantastic book, and I can't wait to read it myself. So congratulations to Andrew, and definitely watch this space. So head over to his website, which I'll have linked in the show notes and on the website, and you'll be able to find out more and read a little bit more about his journey from book to Oscars. Look, I'm just gonna say it's gonna get an Oscar for something, I'm sure. Tune in next week to listen to my interview with Joshua Gillingham. Joshua and myself connected during the first season of the show when he listened to Stephen Black's interview and asked if he could be a guest. And I was very interested in what he was writing, as he's writing a children's series of books and a YA series of books about kind of Vikings and Norse mythology and that kind of thing, which is something I'm very interested in personally. But as well as that, he's also a board game designer. He recently succeeded in raising enough money for his in his Kickstarter campaign for his book All Thingy, which or for his game All Thingy, I should say, of which I was a backer, proud to say. So I'm looking forward to getting to play a game designed by somebody I know. It's going to be very surreal and fun. So that is next week. One thing about next week's episode that I really liked is if you look at the video at the start, I could see the sun out my window, and by the end of the interview, it was dark outside for me, but the sun had risen behind Joshua. So it just really struck me, this interview more than any, of how worldwide podcasting can be. And it was really cool. Anyway, final thing, as always, don't forget to leave a review on podchaser.com/story of a storyteller. It would really help the show. And spread the word, tell your friend, maybe tag somebody in it, who knows. Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you loved listening to this episode just as much as I loved recording it. If you liked the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or over on Podchaser. Until then, be good, be brave, and tell stories. See ya.